Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, this is Aaron Weinacht with the New Books Network, and today we're talking to Dr. Morris Finocchiaro about his new book about the Galileo affair. It's called On Trial for Reason, Science, Religion, and Culture in the Galileo Affair. So thank you for being with us today.
Yes, sure.
So could you start off by telling us a bit about your academic background, how you got to be interested in philosophy of science and Galileo specifically, what you studied, those kinds of things?
Okay. Yeah. In high school, I developed an interest in science, especially physics, especially theoretical physics. And so when I went to college, I went to MIT, where I wanted to focus on science, especially what I called theoretical physics. But now, as I studied it in college, I realized that what I was calling theoretical physics was more what is more properly called the philosophy of physics, namely questions about how did scientists arrive at these laws that what is the relationship between science and other things like the humanities, or between science and philosophy, or between what is the relationship between science and religion. As an undergraduate at MIT, I majored in physics and philosophy, a kind of double major, and I wrote a bachelor thesis on the philosophical interpretations of quantum mechanics. As an undergraduate, I developed an interest in the philosophy of religion, and I studied primarily things like world religions and the arguments for and against the existence of God. But my main scholarly interest, though, was the philosophy of physics and the philosophy of science. So then I went to graduate school in philosophy at the University of California at Berkeley, and so specializing in logic and philosophy of science. And so there I was introduced to something new, namely the historical approach to the philosophy of science, namely the attempt to understand the nature of science and how science works by looking at past episodes and discoveries in the history of science, such as, say, the Copernican Revolution, the Scientific Revolution, the work of Galileo Galilei, or the work of Einstein, and so on. But my focus in graduate school in the historical approach to the philosophy of science led me to write a dissertation on the historiography of science. the logic of the historiography of science, namely arguments for or against the proper method to study the history of science. So, of course, Galileo was mentioned many times by the various authors that I was studying, but I did not have yet a special interest in him. So I say in graduate school, logic and philosophy of science, primarily the historiography of science, and arguments for or against. So the logic part of my graduate studies involved being exposed to an approach to logic that emphasizes practical reasoning, applied logic, actual arguments, rather than just abstractions. And so in logic, I wanted to deal with the analysis, evaluation, and construction of actual arguments. So then, I started, of course, I got a job at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, as an assistant professor of philosophy. And I had to teach courses like Introduction to Philosophy, Introduction to Logic, and then once in a while, Philosophy of Science or Advanced Logic. But now, even in my Introduction to Logic course, since I wanted it to follow an applied and practical argumentation approach, I was always looking for actual arguments, real arguments that had either been given nowadays in contemporary world or in the course of history, actual arguments that had been argued for and against concerning some issues. And so after a few years, and it was not immediate, but after a few years of looking for proper arguments, I came across the arguments for and against the motion of the earth that played a central role in the 17th century with the Copernican Revolution and the Scientific Revolution. Because, of course, a main point of that revolution was that before, in the ancient times up until the 17th century, almost everybody, including scientists and philosophers, believed that the Earth stood still at the center of the universe. But then, after about 100 years of argumentation, experimentation, and so on, then most scientists and philosophers came to believe what we now believe, that the Earth is a planet that moves once a year around the sun, and also once a day, every 24 hours, it rotates on its own axis. Now, so the arguments, I started focusing on the arguments for and against the motion of the earth, and there happens to be a famous book by Galileo Galilei, who, after all, was regarded one of the founders of modern science, and especially perhaps the main one, so much so that many scientists call him the father of modern science. So I focused on this book, a book by Galileo published in 1632 entitled Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems, Ptolemaic and Copernican. And so I had in a portion, of course, even in my Introduction to Logic course, a section of it dealt with the arguments. Now I had the students read, the current translation of that original book. And so I got interested in the analysis of these arguments by Galileo and then by his critics, his opponents, or by people holding different views, including whatever arguments they had, the ancients or the pre-Copernicans, before they came to accept what we now believe, that the Earth does not stand still at the center of the universe, but moves around its own axis and around the sun. So I became interested in Galileo, reading not only this book but other works by him. But now it also so happens that this book, full of argumentation for and against the motion of the Earth, the dialogue on the two chief world system, this book by Galileo, it also, I soon discovered, is the book that led him to be tried as a heretic by the Inquisition. In other words, it was the publication of that book in 1632 that led to complaints against it. And so Galileo, the following year in 1633, had to stand trial with the Inquisition in Rome and ended up being convicted as a suspected heretic. That is, it's not the worst form of heresy, which would have been called the formal heresy, but a milder form of heresy, suspected heresy, for believing and defending the idea that the Earth moves. So now, having discovered this, that this is the book that led to that trial. So the trial, of course, of Galileo in 1633 is one of the best examples to try to understand the relationship between science and religion. Because it leads to questions such as, does the trial prove that science and religion are incompatible? Why or why not? And, it looks like here is a scientist, the father of modern science, who got in trouble with the Catholic Church for the Copernican view that the Earth moves. And so doesn't that disprove incompatibility? Well, maybe or maybe not. Or look more carefully at the documents, at the situation. And so I got interested in studying the trial of Galileo from the point of view of what, if anything, it can tell us, what we can learn from it concerning the relationship between science and religion. And so that's how I became interested in both Galileo, the trial of Galileo, and the problem of the relationship between science and religion, which, of course, also connected to my earlier interest in college in the philosophy of religion. And it connects with my interest in applied logic, and it connects with my interest in the philosophy of science, and the nature of science, and the nature of scientific method. But in a sense, I didn't get involved in this topic until after my studies, until I started teaching at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
So something I wanted to ask you is, the Ptolemaic system had been kind of the general understanding for a very long time. I was wondering if you could summarize some of the key factors that, kind of answer the why now question, right? Why is it that seemingly all of a sudden the Ptolemaic system seems unworkable, at least to some, some researchers?
But so you are asking me what led people like Ptolemy or Aristotle or the ancients to hold that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe, even though that...
Yeah, and then in a related, and then on the other end of the question, why is it that in the, in the 1500s and so on, why is it that a theory that had held sway for so long, why is it that that's the moment when people start to question it and not some other moment?
Yeah. Well, okay. Of course. So originally, for thousands of years, everybody, scientists and philosophers, believed that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe. Now, one main argument for this idea was direct sense experience. namely, the earth feels to be at rest, the heavenly body appear to our eyes to move around the earth. So to believe otherwise would be to go against the evidence, the direct evidence of sense experience. So that was one very basic and common sense argument. I mean, and another argument was that, I mean, that astronomers who had studied the details of the movements of the heavenly bodies, if you study at night exactly how the heavenly bodies move and how some move in certain ways, others move in other ways. Some are called planets, some are fixed stars, the moon also then has its own apparent motion. Well, technical astronomers who studied this were able to explain all these phenomena by assuming that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe and the planets go around it in various orbits with various periods. And the same thing, the fixed stars attached to the celestial sphere once a day around the Earth. In other words, astronomers in ancient times came up with a theory that could explain the details of what was observed. The basic part, the basic view of the theory that explained what was observed was that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe. Now, no other explanation, no other comparable explanation was available. Now, well, but then, of course, I say no other comparable explanation. There were a few people who examined the possibility. Maybe we can explain it by having the Earth move. For example, I mean, the daily apparent motion of all the heavenly bodies around the Earth, like at night, the stars going around the Earth. I mean, that could be explained if it's the Earth that rotates in the opposite direction once a day, and the stars are not moving. So the stars are not moving, the Earth rotates once a day, and so the appearance is, we don't feel that motion, but it generates the appearance of the stars moving around the Earth. So, I mean, that possibility was already thought of in ancient times. But now, as people and astronomers, scientists, and philosophers thought more about it, now they also came up with arguments against this possibility of the Earth moves. In other words, yes, maybe you could explain this way, but there's no way in which the Earth can move. First of all, they say, so here are some of the counter-arguments that led them to reject the possibility that the Earth could move. I mean, well, one is what they called the argument from the deception of the senses. The deception of the senses. I mean, if the Earth is rotating on its own axis, why don't we feel it? Our not feeling it means that our senses would be deceived. Our senses are not telling us the truth. Our senses are lying to us. But that's absurd. I mean, if our senses don't tell us the truth, our knowledge is impossible, and we might as well give up the idea of learning what the world is like. So that... on the basis of this argument from the deception of the senses, they rejected the idea that it could really be true that the Earth moves, even though they could have seen that it could explain some of the motions of the heavenly bodies. But there were other arguments to reject the possibility of the Earth's motion. I mean, for example, one argument had to do with the how things would be happen on a rotating Earth. For example, what would happen to bodies falling freely near the Earth's surface? I mean, suppose you lean out of a window and drop a rock. The rock falls straight down. The falling bodies move vertically downwards. And now it was a thought that that would be impossible on a rotating Earth, because while the falling body was in midair, unattached to the Earth, they thought it should be left behind. The rest of the Earth would be rotating, and so the body would end up falling to the west of where it was dropped. Namely, its path would be slanted. But that's obviously not observed. And so so they concluded that this observation about vertical fall proves that the Earth cannot rotate. And there were other arguments. I mean, another argument was if the Earth rotates around the sun once a year, then when we look at the so-called fixed stars in at night, their apparent position should switch back and forth, because as an observer moves, when you look at an unmoving object, it appears to shift in position. So if the Earth rotates around the sun, which is a very big circle, the Earth's orbit, it means that we are looking at, say, at a given star. Suppose we focus on a given fixed star. We are looking at a given fixed star from very different directions. The difference being like the diameter, being a function of the diameter of the Earth's orbit. And looking at the same object that isn't moving from two very different positions should make the object appear in a different location. So if the Earth moves, revolves around the sun, then any one fixed star should appear to be switching back and forth in the course of a year in its apparent position. But that was not observed. That any one given fixed stars always appear to be in the same place. No shift in its apparent position. And so that was another argument that convinced almost everybody that the Earth must be standing still at the center of the universe. Now, what happened beginning in the 16th century? Well, first of all, what happened is somebody named Copernicus, Nicholas Copernicus, published a book in which he was able to explain the details of astronomical observations on the basis of a moving Earth. In other words, as I said earlier, one great advantage of the ancient theory was that it could explain in a detailed manner why we observe what we do in the heavenly bodies. Well, now, in the 16th century, Copernicus, for the first time, was able to give a detailed explanation of all the fine points of the astronomical observations of the planets and fixed stars and moon. And so this, of course, did not settle the matter, but it started, at least you might say, answered one objection against the motion of the Earth, namely that there was no way to explain the what the movement of the heavenly bodies on the basis of the Earth's motion. Now there was. But still, of course, the arguments, like the argument from the deception of the senses and the argument from the various phenomena, like on the surface of the Earth, like vertical fall of bodies. So those arguments were not answered. And so, well, so more needed to be done. And so the next big step, I would say, came around 1610 when Galileo built a better telescope than had been available up to that time. The telescope had been invented a few years earlier in Holland, but Galileo heard about it and was able to build a better specimen, more powerful than any built up to that time. And so with this telescope, Galileo had the idea of turning it toward the heavens to see what could be seen with it, rather than, say, just, for example, one use of the telescope up to that time had been, for example, in naval battles. If you are equipped with telescope, but your enemy isn't, then you can obviously have an advantage. You can see your enemy ship much earlier than they can see you. But Galileo had the idea of turning it toward the heavens, and he discovered many things, all of which seemed to undermine the idea of the Earth standing still at the center of the universe. I mean, for example, with the telescope, one can see that about the moon, that the moon is has a surface full of mountains and valleys, a rough surface, pretty much like the Earth. So here is a heavenly body, the moon, that is very similar to the Earth, and so the Earth maybe could be itself a heavenly body. But of course, that's certainly no conclusive argument, but it started people thinking. But another thing that could be seen with the telescope was that the planet Venus seemed to show phases similar to those of the moon. In other words, if you follow the planet Venus in its path in the heavens, during a certain periods, its shape is sometimes a full disk, sometimes a half a disk, sometimes it's like a crescent. In other words, the planet Venus shows phases like the moon. Of course, not the same period, but the planet Venus shows phases. Now, one of the many astronomical arguments against the motion of the Earth had been based on the phases of Venus, on the fact that no phases of Venus could be observed. Because, I mean, if the Earth goes around the sun, one of the arguments against the Earth motion claimed, if the Earth goes around the sun, we should be able, then the position of the sun, moon, the sun, the Earth, and Venus changes over the course of a year in such a way that sometimes you should see the full Venus, sometimes a half a Venus, sometimes a crescent Venus. But with the naked eye, this is not seen. And so the argument was, well, the Earth can't move, because if it did, we would see the phases of Venus, but we don't see the phases of Venus. So now comes Galileo with the telescope. Yes, we can see the phases of Venus. So maybe we are moving. But of course, again, this was no conclusive argument. And especially because there was there was one argument against the motion of the Earth. That even the telescopic observation could not answer, namely, the argument about the fixed stars having to show a change of position in the course of a year. This is a change of position that's, the technical name for it is a parallax of the fixed stars, a change in the apparent position if the Earth revolves around the sun. The point is, even with the telescope, you could not see any parallax of the fixed stars. The reason, of course, we now know is because the stars are so far away that the change in the apparent position is so small that even Galileo's telescope and even more powerful telescopes that were built could not see this parallax of the fixed stars. And in fact, it took about 200 years until the 19th century before telescopes were powerful enough to be able to detect the very small annual change in apparent position of the fixed stars. So at the time of Galileo, the situation was relatively controversial. However, of course, in 1632, in the book that I mentioned before, The Dialogue on the Two Chief World Systems, Ptolemaic and Copernican, Galileo undertook a critical examination of all the arguments in favor or against the motion of the Earth, and he was able to criticize all the arguments against the Earth's motion. He tried to strengthen the ones in favor of the Earth moving. And so the arguments in favor of the Earth's motion seemed stronger and were stronger than those against the Earth's motion. And so on the basis of that book and of the critical examination of all the evidence contained in that book, Galileo felt entitled to say that the Earth probably moves. It's more likely that the Earth moves than that it stands still at the center of the universe. So that is a brief account of the Copernican Revolution.
What do you think originally prompted Copernicus to write the book that he did? I mean, you pointed out that it was really the development of technology that, kind of raised Galileo's eyebrows. If we could just go back to Copernicus for a minute, why does he conclude what he does at the time that he does it?
Well, I don't think it's anything in particular, but there is the fact that the details of the heavenly motions had not yet been explained in detail on the basis of the Earth's motion. So for thousands of years, those who believe that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe could say, well, look, there's no way of explaining all of those things. Now, obviously, astronomers, mathematicians are people who like to follow up on the idea whether, well, let's see why or why not. Let's see whether or not or what exactly we can explain if we assume that the Earth moves and whatnot. And in a sense, Copernicus wasn't the first one who tinkered with that idea of trying to work out more of the theory of a moving Earth. But no. And of course, so sooner or later, somebody was focused enough, mathematically proficient enough to work out the details of a theory of a moving Earth and see what the consequences were and see that indeed we could explain the details of the motion of the heavenly body. And so Copernicus was the first one to do it, to work out the details. So sooner or later, I mean, somebody in human history would have done it. And the other people, I mean, did a little bit between Ptolemy, who lived in the 2nd century AD and the 16th century. A number of astronomers did a little bit, but not enough to pose a real alternative there. And Copernicus was the one who did it.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I think at this point we probably need to move to your point that really the Galileo affair is two affairs, right? The original trial, proceedings of the Inquisition, and then all of the various narratives about what that's meant since, you kind of cast as the second of the two Galileo affairs. So I think maybe now might be helpful to listeners to have you sketch out why there are really two Galileo affairs and what those consist of.
Okay. Well, the original, I mean, Galileo affair is simply the original trial of Galileo, and it too, of course, at least two phases. It's I mentioned the book that Galileo wrote, the dialogue in 1632 that led to the trial and condemnation 1633. But there was a background to that in the sense that already in 1616, the Catholic Church had condemned the theory of a moving Earth, the Copernican theory, as being contrary to Scripture. In other words, one of the arguments from ancient times, the motion that in many places it is stated or implied in the Bible that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe. So to say or believe otherwise goes against the Bible, and so goes against religion and is heretical, if you want to use a fancier word. Now, so when Galileo, with his telescopic discovery, started pointing out that is in 1610 and the following few years, when he started pointing out that the situation of the scientific evidence and seemed to be changing, then many religious-minded people started complaining and attacking Galileo that he was trying to undermine religion, undermine the Bible, and so there were already, although Galileo was not brought to trial at that time, but the complaints were filed against Galileo. Yeah, and so in 1616, the Catholic Church condemned the theory that the Earth moves as being against the Bible, as being contrary to Scripture. And Galileo himself, although he was not put on trial, but he was given a warning by an official of the Inquisition, he was given a warrant not to believe or defend or advocate the theory that the earth moves. He had to shut up, so to speak. And so that was in 1616. Now, things were quiet for a number of years, but then in 1623, one of Galileo's admirers became Pope, Pope Urban VIII. And so because of that, Galileo went to, who lived in Florence, went to Rome to pay his respects to the Pope, had a number of audiences with the Pope, was very well received. And Galileo got the impression that if he wrote the proper sort of book about the motion of the earth and the Copernican theory, as long as he stayed away from any biblical interpretations, as long as he wouldn't try to show that that the earth's motion was compatible with the Bible, but as long as he limited himself to scientific and philosophical questions, he could discuss the motion of the earth and the Copernicus theory of the earth's motion. In other words, the Pope, Galileo, got the impression that the Pope did not think that the 1616 condemnation was meant to stop all discussion. It was meant only to stop a certain discussion, trying to prove that the earth's motion is compatible with the Bible. That wasn't supposed to be done. But so, scientific and philosophical evidence and argumentation was allowed. And so Galileo, having gotten this idea from his friendly Pope, wrote the dialogue on the two chief world systems. But then, of course, the conservatives, when they saw the book, that the book did show that it was more likely that the earth moves than it stands still, then they raise all kinds of complaints. They try to show that what Galileo had done was both against the church's declaration against Copernicanism in 1616, as well as being against what Galileo had been warned by officials to do in 1616. And so, Galileo then was found to have violated the church's warnings and the church's dictates of 1616. But so that ended. So Galileo was found to be a suspected heretic, and was condemned to house arrest for the rest of his life. His book was banned. But now, so this was the end of the original, what I call the original Galileo affair, the trial of Galileo. But of course, it started what I call the second Galileo affair, namely the controversy about the meaning and the significance of the original trial. Because, of course, given that Galileo turned out to be right in his scientific evidence and in his philosophical argumentation, then in the last 400 years of cultural history, the most common view is, well, the trial shows that the Catholic Church is an enemy of religion. An enemy of science, and more generally, that religion in general is incompatible with science. So many people have drawn this lesson. And of course, these are not just ignorant people. I mean, some of the cultural icons of Western history. I mean, for example, Voltaire, said so in the 18th century, or Bertrand Russell in one of his books states this, or and so that's a common view. But then, well, the last, but is that view really correct? That's one issue. I mean, other people try to point out that that Galileo committed a number of either both errors as well as he infringed a number of warnings, and so it was Galileo's fault that he ended up being being condemned. And so other in the last 400 years, other authors tried to paint a more negative picture of Galileo and a more positive one of the Catholic Church. Then, of course, in the last 400 years, a number of things have also happened that are part of what I call the second Galileo affair. Namely, see, at one point, at one point in after 1633, the Church itself admitted that the Earth moves. I mean, this came in 1835. See, the Church ended up admitting that Galileo and Copernicus had been right on the scientific issue of the Earth moving. Of course, this happened after more and more evidence, more and more scientific evidence in favor of the Earth's motion was found, including at one point in the early 19th century, the parallax of the fixed stars was observed. So even the Catholic Church at one point had to admit that Galileo was scientifically right, so to speak. And then, now see, and another issue that came up is the one concerning about where does the Bible stand on this? See, Galileo, before, already after the telescope in 1610 and before the 1616 condemnation of Copernicanism by the Catholic Church, he had argued, he had discussed the biblical argument against Copernicanism. He had tried to show that you should not see any conflict because because the Bible is not, should not be treated as a scientific book that gives information about the physical reality. Galileo tried to point out that the purpose of the Bible is to tell us how to go to heaven, how to go to paradise, how should you lead a holy life. So the Bible should not be treated as a scientific or philosophical book that conveys information about the world. And in his argue, in this discussion, Galileo even sought the support and he could point to other great theologians like Saint Augustine, who lived, in the 4th and 5th century AD. Saint Augustine, in a number of his writings, had said similar things. So, and at the time of Galileo, many churchmen also agreed with Galileo that the Bible is not a scientific authority. And so the conflict between what the Bible literally says and what the science may show should be resolved by reinterpreting what the Bible says. So many churchmen agreed with Galileo. Well, now, this kind of discussion continued, of course, after the trial. And eventually, the Catholic Church officially agreed that Galileo was right on this point, too, namely that the Bible is not a scientific authority. This came in the year 1893 when Pope Leo XIII issued an encyclical in which he basically put forth a view of the Bible similar to what Galileo had advocated, that the Bible is not a scientific authority and therefore you should not take that there is a conflict between what science tells us and what's written in the Bible. And so that's, of course, this second affair also extended to our own time when Pope John Paul II tried to work out what was called a rehabilitation of Galileo. In some ways, Pope John Paul II from 1979 to 1992, I mean, in some ways, he did things that helped show that Galileo was right. Eventually, though, that so-called rehabilitation of Galileo ended up in a kind of unsatisfactory manner because other parts of the church, even in 1979 to 1992, other elements of the church were not happy with the rehabilitation of Galileo, and so they tried to resuscitate a common criticism of Galileo that had already been rejected. Namely, the criticism that, yes, although Galileo was right on the earth moves, although Galileo was right, the Bible is not a scientific authority. But his arguments, he did not have a proof of the earth's motion. He did not have a conclusive proof. He was not aware of the limitation of the scientific method. Whereas, according to this criticism, many Catholic officials at the time of Galileo were aware of the limitations of the scientific method in general, the weaknesses of some of Galileo's evidence and arguments, and that's what they were trying to point out to Galileo. Now, so in the rehabilitation of Galileo by John Paul II in 1979 to 1992, this criticism of Galileo was resuscitated, taken up once again, and so some of the writings, but by some of the church officials, try to stress this. But this is, of course, this criticism of Galileo, I feel, is untenable. Through a series of misinterpretations and superficialities, it doesn't understand the complexity of Galileo's argumentation or the fact that he did understand the scientific method better than his opponents. So that's the second affair, which continues, so to speak.
Do you think that something that came up that I found myself thinking about quite a bit as I was reading that last part of your book there is, so we have all these different kind of competing narratives about what the Galileo affair meant. Do you think that subscribing to one or the other of those narratives is simply a matter of kind of picking your tribe, that it's kind of pre-critical? Or do you think that there's, you know, is there actual evidence we can use to say that, you know, one narrative is objectively better than the other? Or at that point, are we kind of getting beyond what, you know, can be empirically shown? You have any thoughts on that?
Well, of course, I mean, I call the second, the affair, I mean, a controversy. So by that, I mean, I don't deny that there are, say, arguments for and against Galileo, for and against the church, whether what the church did to Galileo is right, whether or not what the church did to Galileo had some basis, or whether or not Galileo was free from any fault or any guilt. So, I mean, calling it a controversy means this is a subject for discussion. There are arguments for and against. But, okay, having admitted that, though, I would say that the pro-Galilean side wins. I mean, this argument and this controversy. I mean, when you examine, yes, you listen to the opposite arguments, but then I think that they can all be answered, and there you can show that the pro-clerical position is based on misunderstandings.
So I also took, we're kind of getting close to the end of our hour here, but you know, for me, when I read your book, one of the most important things that emerged was the principle that it's possible to be both reasonable and wrong. And you know, you've spent so much time on Galileo that, you know, it's pretty clear from your book that you think that there's some broader applicability to society now of the controversy that happens in there. So what would you take to be what are some of the lessons here, you know, that you think that those of us here in 2020 should be taking to heart based on what happened and your rendition of it?
Well, let me elaborate very briefly this idea that it is possible to be both reasonable and wrong. In other words, in my book, the account that I give there, I believe, shows that, I mean, for thousands of years until Copernicus and Galileo, almost all scientists and philosophers believed that the Earth stood still at the center of the universe. Now, we know this is wrong. This is false. We know now. But they were reasonable in self-believing, because the available evidence pointed in the direction of the Earth standing still at the center of the universe. It took 150 years to discover that the Earth is not at the center of the universe, and the Earth does move, and it was a long process. It required new instruments, like the telescope, new discoveries, but also a point, I mean, I've not mentioned before, a new physics. There is a physics defined as the science of motion, the science of moving bodies. There was a physics available before Galileo, the Aristotelian physics, but it too was wrong. But I mean, on the basis of that physics, you can't make the Earth move. So you need a new physics, like the law of inertia and the law of force, the law of action and reaction. The engines were reasonable but wrong. Now, at the time of Galileo, many of his opponents were also reasonable, although they turned out to be wrong. But see, as time went on, though, eventually, though, on the question of the motion of the Earth, the point comes when it's no longer even reasonable to believe that the Earth stands still at the center of the universe. Okay, but now, applied, say, to the other controversy over whether how the church treated Galileo and whether Galileo was completely innocent of any fault, So there are arguments for and against, and well, okay, up to a certain point. I mean, it's reasonable to try to find some faults in Galileo, and I mean, including some scientific errors or philosophical limitations. And just like as it's reasonable up to a certain point to try to find some merit in what the church was saying or is saying today, but then, well, you argue out the situation, and you take one point of view and not another. Now, I mean, this situation of say the importance of argumentation, the importance of reasoning, and the fact that often when things are controversial, there can be arguments on both sides, at least up to a certain point and up to a certain level of discussion. Okay, this applies, of course, to almost any controversy. And so one can, one can learn, try by studying the Galileo affair, both the original trial and the subsequent one, one can then try to apply some of these lessons to other controversies. Things like, of course, in a sense, it would be, I mean, I think relatively easy to apply to a controversy like that of evolution, the evolution of the human species versus creation. I think it's relatively easy to apply there, but it has applications there. Another application, a harder one, would be, say, to the controversy about climate change. Well, so what are the arguments for and against? And do they is the evidence conclusive on one side or the other? Or you can, I mean, apply it even to, I mean, politics, meaning, I mean, to say there are two candidates running for a given office. Well, what are the arguments why one is better than the other? You can try to use argumentation and reasoning in that situation too, although of course it gets more difficult as things become more political or more economic, as economic interests start to interfere, for example, with the situation.
Well, I think we're about out of time here, Dr. Finocchiaro. So thank you very much for talking to us about it. I certainly enjoyed reading the book. In fact, I'll probably return to it and read it again at some point here in the near future. So thank you very much.
Okay, it was my pleasure. Thank you.